dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy night, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. One of the most heinous thefts perpetrated against the American people by the corporate government alliance is the theft of free speech and a truly free press on the public airways. Yes, we have these rights on paper, but in reality, the exercise of these rights is fully denied to all but the wealthy. The rights of free speech and press were expressly intended to protect political discourse. Discourse involves the ability not only to speak, but also to be heard and in turn to hear the responses of others. In our society, the electronic media is at the center of that discourse, and it remains almost fully under corporate control. Even much of so-called public broadcasting has been given over to corporate underwriting and coverage pleasing to the wealthy. The media today advances views that benefit the bottom line of its owners and excludes or ridicules ideas and information that might negatively impact the financial situation of its advertisers. This was demonstrated rather starkly recently by the case of the Fox TV reporters who were ordered to lie and ultimately fired for refusing to suppress material which revealed unpleasant truths about the products and conduct of their advertiser, the Monsanto Corporation. What was unusual was that the reporters fought back and sued and won. In the process, they've lost their homes and effectively ended their careers in broadcast journalism. Most reporters keep quiet or leave the news business in disgust. The radio station you are listening to is one of the very few where some community members can gain access to the airwaves that we supposedly own and exchange ideas with our community. There are very few opportunities of this kind. For every struggling community radio station, there are thousands that exist for the purpose of making profits through advertising sales, where the program is not the purpose, but the bait to catch the suckers. These stations are owned by a decreasing number of media conglomerates. The price tags for these stations are in the millions. This has all been made possible by the policies of the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, which regulates the granting of broadcast licenses, and by the politicians in thrall to the National Association of Broadcasters, the NAB. The NAB has a budget of $35 million a year to lobby for the interests of corporate broadcasters. According to a report by Common Cause, the NAB aggressively blocked campaign finance reform by threatening to retaliate against politicians who have supported legislation to get corporate money out of politics. No politician can get elected in America today without exposure in the electronic media. This program on Welcome Guests is unusual in that it presents coverage of news and ideas from the perspective of the working class. Why should such views be so unusual on the airwaves of a supposedly free country where the majority of people are workers as opposed to millionaires? Whole areas of thought and whole communities of people have been rendered invisible, voiceless, by the phenomenon best expressed in the maxim, freedom of the press belongs to he who owns the press. Yet we are the nominal owners of the airwaves, and all over the country, a movement has sprung up of people asserting their right to broadcast. This is the Free Radio Movement, also known as Pirate Radio. Tonight we'll focus on the fight for low-power community radio, micro-radio. We're going to air a video documentary by Kevin Kaiser titled Free Radio, which we have adapted for radio. During the last week, media activists confronted the National Association of Broadcasters at their convention in San Francisco. Some of the producers of this program are there covering the event, and we'll be bringing you material about that showdown in future broadcasts of Unwelcome Guests. The documentary we're going to hear tonight will chronicle the issues and activism which led the FCC to agree to restore the granting of low-watt FM licenses. However, this is by no means assured. The NAB has pressured Congress to derail the proposal. Nevertheless, for the moment, the FCC is taking applications for some low-power FM licenses, and we'll tell you where to get more information on that at the end of the program. The documentary was completed before the FCC had made the final decision to grant low-power licenses last spring. We've taken the liberty of updating the information wherever possible, where we can do so without unduly altering the documentary's message. These licenses, by the way, used to be available, and it was National Public Radio that lobbied hardest for their elimination during the 1970s so that it could build its empire. And National Public Radio is standing with the NAB to kill the new radio service. Here is Free Radio by Kevin Kaiser, with a little help from some unwelcome guests. In 1978, the FCC outlawed radio broadcasting under 100 watts, effectively eliminating low-cost community radio stations in the United States. The 1996 Telecommunications Reform Act eased restrictions on how many stations a company could own in any given market, sparking a stampede of buyouts and takeovers at radio stations throughout the country. After years of grassroots efforts by so-called pirate radio stations, the FCC has approved a proposal to open up the airwaves and give low-power FM access back to the public.
Here's a way for people to have a voice.
Stephen Dunifer, founder of Free Radio Berkeley.
You have your basically a simple transmitter, mixer, microphone, CD player, power supply, antenna, whatever. It's a very simple process, and this is the means by which people can communicate in their communities, they can speak truth to power, and they can seize back what has been stolen from them, the airwaves.
San Marcos, Texas.
Good.
Anyone okay. Of appropriate medical science. But to say that this is the only avenue, I don't buy it.
Okay.
I also think it sends a very bad message to our children, and I can tell you.
What sends a bad message? Which is worse message to send to the children? Let's let our parents suffer and die sooner, or let them have the pain relief they need?
No, the message that's being sent is that there is nothing wrong with marijuana, that it's good for you, that it The
this
kids are now saying, oh, it cures cancer. So they're getting a missed message. And
what? Nobody has said
it just
cured.
Opens the door for, gosh, we knew we couldn't trust the old folks anyway. They want to keep all the good stuff for themselves.
What happened to the 70 million of us if they took 100 million of us from home?
Springfield, Illinois.
I know, people are always going to say, when are y'all going to give that a rest? And every time you watch Fury or Flicka, and you watch the horse look over the corral gate at the open pastures and remember the days it used to run free, you cry crocodile tears. But when an African say, we long to be home, you talk this stupid stuff about, why don't y'all give that up? Well, see, what's going to change is our assessment of what we think about our home, right?
Mm-hmm.
And once we change, then it don't matter what other people say. And this is what we're in the process of doing. We get together like this every night to kind of like do ourselves this kind of therapy thing.
Santa Cruz, California.
We make it our business of providing you with information. Information that's unfiltered. For example, this short tidbit of information. Did you know that there's a class action lawsuit against the city of New York by 63,000 citizens who were illegally strip searched during 96 and 97?
Nah, you got it all wrong. It's deeper objective understanding.
San Francisco, California.
Developmental techniques of the sacred transpersonal transformation. And you've got to have spiritual bioenergetic process or you can't have holistic ongoing channeling. Don't you understand?
Well, I think the most important thing is to have an intense subjective understanding of the Eastern experiential process and just let yourself feel the alternative synchronic relationship between the spiritual meditative integration.
Now that makes a little bit of sense to me, but you're forgetting about the vibrant developmental continuum of sacred transpersonal transformation of the empowering interactive awareness.
Stephen Denifer.
The fact of the matter is the airways belong to the people. They belong to us. They've been usurped by the FCC and have been basically given to the corporations to make an immense amount of profit from, and at great detriment to essentially the common good. And to me, the situation is pretty unequivocal. We have to have the airways back for our communities to be able to communicate, to establish our own voices, to do what we think should be done with the airways at a community level. And if the FCC wants to stand in the way of that, fine.
Greg Ruggiero, author of Microradio and Democracy.
1934, the FCC was created to regulate the airwaves in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. But over time, the corporations and the private interests have gained control of the airwaves to a point now where the mere prospect of using a tiny little sliver of the airwaves for public interest, convenience, and necessity is met with federal marshals who come storming in and shut you down, as has been the case in the past couple of years. 400 stations have been shut down for using the airwaves for free speech.
In the last 2 years, there has been something in the neighborhood of 525 stations that have closed down.
David Fisk, Federal Communications Commission.
Over 400 of those have been on a voluntary basis. So we will sometimes pay visits two or three times to people. We are not looking to go to court. That's a last resort. We are not looking for seizures. That is a last resort. It's only when people are intransigent.
The FCC came by once and wanted to look at the transmitter, and I denied them access.
Skidmark Bob, Free Radio Santa Cruz.
And they said, well, you're breaking another law, not letting us in. I said, no, that's only if I had a license. What's your name? Well, I'm Skidmark Bob. And he got his clipboard out, and, you know, they had phones holstered. I guess that's what they think their guns are, but they had little phones.
Well, our engineer has taken our transmitter and submerged it. It's in a pressure pot that's filled with oil.
Reckless and Feral. Two programmers from Free Radio Austin.
So that
waterproof?
That's waterproof. It's like watertight sealed. The cords are coming out of top of the pressure pot. And it's basically so that we can bury it underground and not have to worry about the heat, about our transmitter overheating because we can't put a fan on it, which is usually
Texas.
And we're in Texas and it's real hot. So it's underground submerged in oil, so the heat from the transmitter will distribute into the oil and be released through the ground. And we put some steel rebar through there, laid some concrete on top so that if the FCC wants our transmitter, they're gonna have to work for it.
What is the FCC so worried about us about? We've got a pretty positive message and they're allowing some really crazy, you give them a couple of bucks and you can say anything, I mean, you know.
The more of these micro stations, these community stations that can start up, the better.
Filmmaker Michael Moore, speaking from the WTO protests in Seattle in 1999.
And we need to also fight for legislation that allows them to operate without the other stations coming down on them or the FCC.
Yeah, you know they're considering that now. They put forward an LPFM proposal.
Right, that's right.
A lot of people are kind of cynical about what's going to happen.
Well, that's okay. Those people should stay cynical because they keep everybody else honest. Yeah.
A lot of the people have been fighting for LPFM now are worried that with government regulation they won't be able to say what they want to say.
And then a whole new system of pirate radio will start up to fight the LPFM.
Do you think it's necessary with the changes, you know, the big buyouts in government and the Telecommunications Act, do you think it's a necessary alternative voice?
Well, we're at a point now where we don't have any voice. You know, five corporations essentially own most of the media in this country. Hang on one second here, okay?
No democracy can really thrive in a fundamental deep sense if it has to rely so heavily on the commercial mass media.
Ralph Nader, consumer advocate.
And so there arises over the golden horizon what is called community media, nonprofit media, media that deals with news as worthy of the attention of dignified human beings, media that does not trivialize, does not sensationalize, does not aim for the lowest impulses of its desired audience, a media that engages discussion and debate, a media that does not place commercial values over news values, over the values of people's right to know and right to discuss and right to voice.
Ben Bagdikian, former dean, UC Berkeley School of Journalism.
David and Goliath lets David win in the Bible, but in the free market, Goliath wins.
What is the whole thrust of the radio thing? It's about advertising. It's about selling stuff.
Mbana Kantako, Human Rights Radio.
Why in the world would, I mean, it's kind of clear that if you poor, you can't buy all that stuff on there, so they ain't talking to you anyway.
E-Loan is an equal housing lender and not currently licensed in
Just rely on their Chevrolet cars to go the distance. And everyday hard-working Americans.
Call 1-800-CELLULAR for the one that works, Cellular One.
That really works well. I'm Tom Shane, and our selection of single wedding rings.
Syndicated, uniform national broadcasting is much more profitable for the big stations.
Ben Bagdikian.
And so we lose in terms of civic vitality as well as the fairness. Because after all, the public owns the airwaves, although you wouldn't know that by listening to the broadcasters. They actually own by law the airwaves. And the FCC has the responsibility for allocating with that in mind. But I think the FCC has forgotten it in the last 30, 40 years.
Well, a lot of us, like when we started the station, I was homeless. So I was on the street all the time. I was seeing this shit go down all the time. So I said, well, I might as well have a tape recorder. And we have a little power now because we have this transmitter. We could take it there and play this person getting arrested by this cop and get the cop's name and talk about him on the air. And before that, people just didn't have access to that. You know, it's like you go to KUSP or you go to KZSE, one of the local public stations. They just laugh at you. We're not going to play that on the air. And so we have our own show and we'll play that. Robert Norris, Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, he plays a lot of interviews with homeless people that he gets that are never aired because everybody's afraid of homeless people. And so we put it on the air and people hear about that culture and hear about how, you know, how things are.
Welcome to Fox In Depth. I'm David Asman. There's a war raging all around us, but you can't see it. The reason you can't see it is because the battleground is on invisible airwaves. The issue? Who has the right to broadcast radio signals over those airwaves? For more on
the newest Twin Cities radio station is the buzz of the broadcast world. It's slick, it's happening, and it's illegal.
They're radio rebels at war with the FCC.
But because the amateur station isn't licensed yet, listeners may also be getting an earful of profanity.
The FCC estimates there are hundreds of unlicensed pirate radio stations operating illegally across America. When it finds them, it shuts them down.
Well, the commission's policy is really quite simple.
Pamela Henderson, FCC spokesperson.
You must obtain a license before you can broadcast.
What do you think about this?
You found the beat of Minneapolis.
Good dance music.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Good beat.
And the law is knocking at the door.
The pirate station is living by none of these rules.
97.7 on the dial is an unlicensed station, a so-called micro-broadcaster transmitting secretly.
Jim Wycor, Minnesota Broadcasters Association.
If we allow anyone that can go out and build a transmitter or buy a transmitter to use the airwaves, it's going to be chaos, utter chaos.
Ralph Nader.
When radio came on, everybody said, aha, it's going to be the voice of the people. It's going to be decentralized. It's going to be nonprofit. It's going to be what Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover in 1920 said will be forever a public trust and never commercialized with the contamination of advertisements. Can you imagine? And that struggle went on for a few years between the educational radio organizations and the commercial radio organizations. And the commercial radio organizations ended up winning.
I mean, the mainstream media is controlled by just a few corporations, so all the information that goes out is basically what those corporations want us to hear, and we're giving the alternative view, like what we're seeing in the real news, like what the stuff, nothing's covered, nothing at all these days. There's a lot going on.
It's been totally homogenized to serve certain market groups of people.
The point of the micro-radio movement is to try and go into those small spaces where the airwaves aren't being controlled by the corporate sector and open them up for community use.
We're opposed to it mainly because of the interference that we think this is going to create and cause to existing broadcasters.
Dennis Wharton, National Association of Broadcasters.
Anyone who listens to radio understands that interference is a big problem, and we think that the LPFM proposal is likely to cause significant interference to existing stations.
Here's a station that can, we can do anything we please. We can have people pioneering in music. We can have people discussing local issues. We can have people discussing world issues in a manner that any kind of sponsored radio cannot do. And thanks to the web, we can take this little station and talk to the whole world eventually.
Radio is the bomb. You can carry it around with you. You can, you know, work it in your neighborhood. It doesn't cost thousands of dollars to have your own station. You're not going to make airplanes fall from the sky. That's a bunch of crap. And it's a bunch of crap to keep the consolidation of the media in control of the very few wealthy hands. Think about it. 99.9% of the population does not have access to the public airwaves.
Jesse Drew of Paper Tiger Television talked about Mbana Kantako of Human Rights Radio in Springfield, Illinois. Kantako, who is blind, started his first Black Liberation Radio while living in the John Hay Homes Housing Project.
Mbana Kantako has been an inspiration for a lot of the mini FM transmitters for a long time, and his case was definitely seen as one of the original sort of litmus test cases in terms of fighting for mini FM radio as a free speech issue.
Black Liberation Radio, again, was another source of inspiration for what we decided to do.
Stephen Denifer.
That was begun probably around 1988 by Mbana Kantako, who started Black Liberation Radio out of a housing project called the John Hay Housing Project in Springfield, Illinois. Essentially, the housing project was, you could consider it basically to be an urban bantustan. In other words, this is basically where pretty much most of the people of color had been isolated in that community, largely due to class and race differences. And they were subject to all kinds of abuse from the police and other agencies.
Mbana Kantako, Rights Radio.
Oh, yeah. Once again, it's that time of the day when the station gets truly funky. But right about now, I've got something special for ya. As I speak, this radio station is taking over the airwaves. Follow for now,
and do not attempt to change the channel.
Zalango, this is Kanadi Kentaco, back with another edition of Notes on the Devil's News for our 3,889th night of broadcasting. I'll be dropping the headlines while Nabana gives you the stories. He'll be breaking them down for the way to help you see through the devil's tricks and lies. Remember, Notes on the Devil's News is a Human Rights Radio exclusive presentation, meaning you can hear Notes on the Devil's News here at Human Rights Radio.
That is right, and indeed, we's in our 3,889th night of broadcasting, and welcome to another edition of Notes on the Devil's News. There are a couple things you got to remember when you listen to Notes on the Devil's News. Number one, we do not call this garbage news. And number two, we do not call this garbage that these devils do be calling news. True. But what we will do is add truth to it. Hope that you is going to see it for what it is.
Every day we at least do a 90-minute program we call Notes on the Devil's News. That's where we go over. What I use it to do is to reinforce what Malcolm's taught about, you know, analyzing things. Mm-hmm. We'll take the stories that, say, the mainstream press call the news, and we critique them with an intent of showing people how to critique and that we better learn how to critique and stop waiting for Dan Rather to give us our opinion, right?
One of the problems that any group doing community organizing, or in this case tenant organizing, is bound to run into is how you do outreach, how you get in touch with people, get them activated, get them aware of the issues and so on.
Ron Sokolsky, author of Seizing the Airwaves.
And so there were a number of ideas that were floated about, you know, how to do that. I mean, obviously ringing doorbells is one way, having a chat with somebody directly. But there are other ways that people, you know, might be reached also. And so aside from a newspaper format, which had been tried, one day people were just sitting around and brainstorming what could be done. And the idea came up of doing radio. It was almost like sort of laughingly mentioned as, well, why don't we have our own radio station?
Mike Townsend, professor, University of Illinois, Springfield.
People would start coming by the apartments and, you don't really have a radio station in here, do you? You know, they'd have to actually come in and you know, if you see this stuff, it doesn't take up much room and it's really hard to believe. I know when we got the transmitter, it looked like an oversized cigar box, you know. We were expecting this big crate, you know, to come in. We'd have to pry off the wood casing and, you know, haul this thing out. And, you know, this thing comes in a box and it's like this. And this is a transmitter?
Yeah. We came on the air November 25th, 1986, and went relatively unknown until March 1989. In March of 1989, a series of police brutality cases came to our attention here at the station, and we attempted to cover them. In the final case, we call it the Gregory Court Massacre, where three of our people were killed by a death squad of police, masked men with weapons, automatic rifles, flak jackets, jumpsuits, dressed for a war. We covered that story, and that's when the chief of police at the time filed a complaint with the FCC. He claimed that some people had called him and told him we was cussing on the radio.
Now, the radio station did do on-the-spot coverage of police situations that were either violent or potentially violent. And there was a siege laid to one particular person's house that ended in bloodshed. And Mbana was right there on the spot giving, you know, people directly information about what was going on. The police, of course, did not like that at all.
That's who was really giving us the hard time when we started the station, was the police. You know, they was, at one point they got to it where they just straight out killed somebody. They said, okay, y'all don't think we serious, do y'all? Whomp, they just beat the blood out of a man, you know? So the station grew out of our effort to find a way to resolve these kind of problems, you know?
I would say that the major accomplishment from that early period was, And I attribute this really almost solely to Mbana's efforts with the radio station, was the great decline in overt police brutality against blacks in this community. It was not unusual to have blacks beat up, occasional deaths at the hands of the police and this kind of thing. But if you listen to some of the tapes that he did with victims of police brutality, I mean, they're just chilling accounts.
He grabbed his handcuff out of the back of them and slammed the door on their face and charged over there by me and grabbed me. So I balled up. And so I balled up. So I said, the nurse asked, could you leave the handcuff off me, you know, until I get through with the x-ray and feel like right there. And so he reached back and hit me two times. Hit me with the handcuffs on my left side of my face, hit me with his fist on my right.
He hit you. You said your cousin opened the door?
He opened the door. When he opened the door, he seen the couples, he seen Bridges on my back.
Mm-hmm. Bridges was on you at the
time? On my back.
On the bed with you?
No, on the floor.
Oh, he had not. How did you get on the floor?
When he hit me.
Oh, it knocked you on the floor?
Yeah.
And he jumped down there on you?
Yeah, he was down there on me. He was down there on me.
Doing what?
Hitting me.
He wasn't trying to put no handcuffs on me?
No, I don't know what he was trying to do, and I was balled up. And then next thing you know, I come over the door and looked in, and all those people inside the hallway, and opened the door, all those people was inside the hallway, looking inside and see what that. And my blood was coming from the side of my face, coming down from the side of my face.
What did Bridges do when he saw people looking?
He was shocked. Because it was like he was caught into something that he knew he had no business doing.
When the nurse came back, what did the nurse say?
She didn't say one word. She seen the blood coming down from the side of her face.
There was no blood before she left the room?
Sure wasn't. It wasn't nothing but that right there, gash in the upper, that gash that I was supposed to be treated for up at the top part of my eyebrow. That person they got treated for, and then when she came back, it was another gash at the side of my face in my temple.
Blood. How was Bridges when the nurse came back?
How was he?
Yeah.
He was just standing there.
He just standing there.
Mm-hmm. Did standing there. He ain't say nothing. And when he shut the door back again, he said, "I loved it."
Oh, was the nurse in the room when he came?
Nah. He said, "I loved it. I thought you loved it, huh?" He said, "Yeah, I love busting your head."
Springfield being the capital of Illinois. The home of Abraham Lincoln. They just couldn't have this stuff going out over the air, you know. And they had plans, even in the works back at that time, to build a multi-million dollar, I know, probably going to be $100 million before it's done, presidential library. They just couldn't have police being exposed, killing and beating up blacks in Lincoln's home. I mean, just as simple as that. And so now they beat up whites. I mean, poor whites. I swear to God, if you look back over the recent cases of police brutality in Springfield, it's poor white guys that are getting pushed around. It doesn't happen too much to blacks anymore. So, I mean, and that to us demonstrated the power of micro radio. I mean, he had like, I don't know, 5 watts or something of power at that time. And the fact that you could make, you know, such a major impact on the community in a very, very important area convinced us that, you know, this was the way to go.
Because the 5-0 is on your block with their little whirling lights out there, and they'll come in your house and they'll whoop the living hell out you, and nobody you know will say a word. Man, I'm telling you, man, y'all ever heard of this group out of the criminal enterprise called San Francisco called Food Not Bombs? I got some tapes. I did some interviews with them, man. This is a group of white dudes, you know, the liberal types. They go out and do shit like give away food, and the police be kicking their ass, man, don't they? They do. They be locking them up. They come out and they beat them. No giving away food. This is why you are afraid to deal with human rights. Because if they get on you about giving away food, you know why they're against giving away food, don't you? Somebody might not bow down at work because they got a plate coming anyway, right? So you bow down at work because without that, you can't feed yourself, see? And they know that, see? These fools don't have no respect for your human rights. What you're going to have to do is you're going to have to be about the business of educating yourself to the point where you respect yourself. See? With their education, you have no respect for yourself, right?
Right.
I mean, and that's why you don't trip on human rights. People say, "I think that's radical." No, I think you're a coward. That's what I think.
In a crooked place called Springfield, yeah, that criminal operation on the front line of the struggle is this low-watt radio station. Sister Dia and Ivana bringing knowledge to the people, dropping science like big giants going toe-to-toe with evil.
What we're able to do, we combine the knowledge of the elders with the kind of funky beat that everybody kind of liked, you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
And yeah, that oh man, we got kids. You'll see tonight, I've got a group of 6 to 12-year-old brothers. They're going to sit down at 6 o'clock and start writing, and they won't care if they don't stop until 8. Now, this is after being at school all day.
Yeah.
Well, why is that? Because this is something that's relevant to them. This is something that means something to them. This is something that's going to, you know, help them in their own development.
Once the Hay Home started getting boarded up as people left, and it became clear that eventually it would be demolished, those boarded up houses that were no longer being occupied were used by Mbana for his various programs that he has with youth that today happen elsewhere because the Hay Homes are no longer there. But he saw the waste of all this space, and he would have a library, like he had the Marcus Garvey Library, actually it was the Malcolm X Library, and he had various you know, programs for young people. And he has a presence in the community to this day based on that, where people realize that he, you know, he's not just somebody on the radio, but that he's actively involved in working with the kids in the neighborhood and, you know, being a voice for the voiceless in general on the radio, and in beyond the radio, being somebody who has taken an active interest in making that community strong.
We started this program working with children in 84 when Mike and I met. They're learning the most important thing, that is who they are. And nobody can live without that knowledge. Marcus Garvey said, a people without knowledge of themselves is like a tree without roots. We'll have peace and harmony among us.
We'll be loving.
Sharing. And creating. We will work. Study. And listen. So we may learn. Learn so we may teach.
At the present time, you know, they're fronting this idea of, you know, low power radio and so on, and contending that they're not opposed to, you know, low power radio, and at the same time they're going after people all over the country. If they go after Mbana, I think he represents, since he's in some ways the founder of the movement, many people acknowledge him as that within the movement. He represents more than just one station, one isolated individual. He has community roots, and he has an important connection nationally to the movement as a whole.
We already got, you know, if they do come and take this transmitter, we got another one already in town that's ready to go as soon as they leave out the door, so we ain't worried about it. That's not an issue.
How many times? Go back on the air?
Oh, sure. We go stay on it. So they have to, you know, when they come, if they come at this one, what they need to plan on is what they're going to do about the second one. And the third one, okay? It's like by any means necessary kind of thing, you know what I mean?
You worried about fines?
Ain't got no money. If I had some money, I might, but I ain't got no money, okay? Nah, I ain't worried about them and their fines. I ain't worried about nothing they got.
Tetsuo Okagawa, Japanese low power FM pioneer.
So my argument is very simple. The present media is too large and wasteful. From now on, we should think about the smaller media to diverse our culture and community.
Tetsuo Kagawa is an activist and an intellectual who lives in Japan. And he was in Europe in the 70s at a time when pirate radio was sort of a major phenomenon there. The anarchist groups and activist groups were getting involved in setting up pirate radio stations in Italy and France. And he was sort of got turned on by that idea while he was living there. And then when he went to Japan, he started a very powerful mini-FM movement, primarily in Tokyo, that at one point grew to, I believe, more than 3,000 mini-FM stations in Tokyo.
Students of mine started a radio station using this kind of technique in university campus. And they had a good audience in Tokyo. And in a year, over 1,000 of stations appeared. Very quickly.
Well, part of the reason, you know, this project, you know, came to be, you know, we drew inspiration from different people, and one of those was Tetsuo, who, you know, conceived of essentially neighborhood radio stations in Japan, places that were small enough that you could essentially bicycle to you know, have a little neighborhood radio station, which pretty well fit with my concept of what we were doing, perhaps on a little bit larger scale.
the technology of mini media is easy to control, so that we can be independent from the expert authorities and special institutions.
I had met him here and spoke with him about building mini FM transmitters, and I thought that was a really interesting idea. So I invited him to come to a special meeting at my house, I invited a bunch of other people to come, and he came and we had dinner together, and he built up a transmitter in front of us as we sort of sat around the room and was speaking about, you know, the politics of radio, and we built up a mini FM transmitter right there, and we went live, and we were sort of probably one of the first mini FM transmitters operating, at least in the Bay Area.
This plug is connected to the monitor jack here. Hello? Hello?
And the idea was that, you know, people could build these, at least to get the hands-on experience. In other words, the whole concept was to kind of empower people with the idea that they could make their own transmitters, which was a viable concept, and that's one we've, you know, continued to this day.
Well, Stephen Dunifer is a key figure in the whole movement.
Ron Sokolsky, author of Seizing the Airwaves.
Free Radio Berkeley, you know, was a very significant, you know, player in the whole movement. He helped organize conferences that were micropower radio conferences. He also, you know, was involved in getting transmitters to people, not only here but internationally. And he's been very much concerned with, you know, seeing the growth of this movement happen. So he's played a very significant role.
Captain Fred, Free Radio Berkeley programmer.
When I read the East Bay Express article about Stephen in 1993 and heard about what this guy was doing in Berkeley, I realized immediately, that's what I want to do too.
1990, we were contacted by Mike Townsend concerning Mbana Kantako.
Alan Korn, National Lawyers Guild.
And we were informed about what he was doing on the air using low-power radio in Illinois. So one of the first things we did, and this is when I got involved with the committee, was to prepare a proposed legal brief that Mbana could use in the event that he decided to pursue legal action. At that point, I think he'd been fined a certain amount of money. At that point, actually, they were fining him in the realm of like $100 or $500. I forget now. Not like the, you know, $10,000, $20,000 fines that are now regularly being issued. And Mbana was going to challenge it. So what I was involved in was preparing a legal brief. It came to about 120 pages that he could use in the event he chose to challenge the fine. At some point, he declined to use to go in affirmatively, you know, and do a legal challenge. So at that point, the Lawyers Guild, we had this 110, 120-page brief, and we were looking for other micro-broadcasters that we could represent. At a presentation that was given at the New College, I recall Stephen Dunifer was there, and he later contacted us and told us about his wanting to go on the air to protest the coverage of the Gulf War. And at that point, we hooked up with him and began to prepare a legal challenge using a lot of the research that was initially done for Mbana Kantako in Springfield.
And they were doing it on a neighborhood range basis, very low power. It began in Berkeley, California, right here, on a hill right near my house.
Ben Bagdikian.
And a man put some stuff in a van he put together and got up on the hill, and he broadcast every night on what was going on in the black community and in City Hall and so forth. And did it for a while, and then the government, and then it turned out to be a movement. There were at least 200 pirate stations in the country, and some people have said more, maybe twice as many, because it's so easy to do and there was such a need for it. So they arrested this man, and the fine is $10,000 or 10 years in prison, not a small thing, and closed him down. But it was uncontrollable. Since it was illegal, but they even had a conference, a national conference in San Jose, California, and there were 400 pirate broadcasters who showed up. And since it was uncontrollable, it was clear that they couldn't stop it.
Yes, and good evening once again. This is Free Radio Berkeley, on the air and on time, amazing folks. What you're listening to right now is the Mexican revolutionary music from the 1930s in the ranchera style. We've got some very good programs for you this evening. Some more information on what's happening in Chiapas. And we have the Radman back with us tonight. And some good music and all kinds of good information. So stay tuned. This is Free Radio Berkeley, 88.1 on your FM receiver. And back to the music.
Free Radio Berkeley itself went on the air on April 11th, 1993.
Stephen Dunifer, founder of Free Radio Berkeley.
Essentially, the goal and purpose of this was to, one, establish it as a free speech voice, as a First Amendment activity, to challenge the FCC's regulatory policies that essentially prohibited this type of operation from occurring, and essentially provide a voice for the community. And that's always been the reasons for this project, and pretty much the reasons for the whole movement, really, to unequivocally claim our First Amendment rights, to challenge the status quo, and be a voice for the voiceless. And that's really, I would say, the underlying operating principles of this movement, essentially.
NPR claims to do all of those things. Do you think that they've succeeded or failed in their mission in that regard?
They fail. They have failed miserably. I mean, they're a voice for Archer Daniel Midland's, not for the people. I mean, people have to differentiate between quote-unquote access, if there's any at all, and having a voice. There's a vast difference between just merely having access and having a voice. Micro radio, low power FM, free radio gives people a voice in their own communities because it gives them their own station by which to speak to one another and share their ideas, their news, their cultures.
Joe Patak, Kind Radio.
You see, we're a national public radio. There's just an analysis done on who is actually on their news shows, who they are relying on to provide information. And the overwhelming majority of sources quoted on NPR are corporate or government bureaucrats or paid political consultants. You don't have representatives of labor unions, you don't have representatives of consumer or environmental organizations, and you sure don't have any regular people.
So in any event, Stephen had his attorney Luke Hyken respond to the FCC.
Alan Korn, National Lawyers Guild.
And he sent a very well-reasoned 10, 12-page letter based on a lot of the arguments that, you know, we had put together in the Mbana brief. And he continued to broadcast, and the FCC never responded. They never really issued a response to the legal arguments that Stephen presented about why the prohibition on low-power FM was unconstitutional.
January of 1995, the FCC attempted to get a federal injunction against Stephen Dunifer and Free Radio Berkeley. At that time,
Captain Fred, Free Radio Berkeley programmer.
Their motion was turned down by Judge Claudia Wilkin, 9th District Federal Court. She said she saw it as an issue of free speech and she wasn't going to grant them an injunction. Those of us in Free Radio Berkeley were very excited by this decision, and shortly thereafter, February 5th of 1995, we turned down our transmitter nonstop.
In this gray area, you know, in this breach, all these micro radio broadcasters jumped on the air, which created a real enforcement problem for the FCC. I mean, a judge hadn't yet ruled it was constitutional to prohibit this low power FM stuff. The judge was waiting for them to respond to Dunifer's thing. And it took the FCC like another 9 or 10 months to even respond to the issues raised by Stephen. And even then, they just sort of said, look, we've looked at this before. We're never going to look at this prohibition on low-power FM again. It's just, you know, we believe that it's constitutional. They didn't really address this stuff. And in fact, the arguments about diversity on the airways that Stephen raised, they said, well, there's plenty of diversity on the airways. And anyway, it's up to us to decide whether or not there is. And we've decided that there is. Some sort of convoluted circular logic.
The Dunifer case garnered widespread media coverage.
Joining us now in our San Francisco bureau is pirate radio station operator for Radio Free Berkeley, Stephen Dunifer. Mr. Dunifer recently won a victory against the FCC when a federal judge refused an injunction by the commission to shut down his pirate radio station. And in Boston, we're joined by the vice president for the Talk America Radio Network, Tom Starr. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. Stephen Dunifer, let me go to you first. Why is it so important to operate your station in defiance of the FCC?
It's important because it's a First Amendment issue that we're fighting here. The FCC has created such high barriers of entry that only the rich and well-endowed can have a voice in this country now. And what we're seeking to do is establish some alternative to that, that would allow every community to have its own voice through inexpensive, low-cost, low-power FM stations that can easily be put together and can meet all the basic technical requirements mandated by the FCC. We're just basically seeking a more level playing field so that the average person and the community can have access to what is theirs, the airwaves.
Now, Tom Starr, what's wrong with what Mr. Dunifer is doing?
Well, first of all, I dispute that what's going on in the country is that you cannot buy a radio station if you're not part of the rich and famous, because I know many radio station owners that have radio stations and don't have a lot of money. We're able to go to a bank and borrow the money and be able to put on a facility not maybe as elaborate as some of the other major radio stations, but more importantly, what we have to be concerned about is who's going to take care of making sure that signals don't get blocked by those radio stations that are legal. And I think also we have to make sure that we don't have radio stations being taken over by people who are going to hurt us as free Americans. And I think that is a very important issue.
Excuse me, Mr. Starr. How can free speech hurt us as Americans, free speech on the airwaves?
Well, one problem that I can foresee at this moment is that if you have one radio station, you can have hundreds of radio stations all across the country. And if you want to, you could provide the same programming from one location and do it by satellite. You could, if you wanted to, you could start a riot. You could even start what the Sandinistas did in Nicaragua.
Explain what you mean, what the Sandinistas did in Nicaragua. Again, the airwaves, how are they in defiance of our First Amendment rights?
Because if you have a license and you're able to do the work that you portray that you're going to do, at least you have certain requirements you have to meet. You can say what you want, you can do what you want, but there are rules and regulations that keep you to say, you know, everybody go march on the Capitol and go burn down a building or whatever it might be. You can't do that if you own a radio station, from the FCC rules and regulations.
Okay, well,
but
we're going to get
do
into
whatever
the,
you want.
We're going to get into the political implications in just a second. But Mr. Dunifer, is there any way you can operate these small radio outlets without interfering with other radio waves?
Yes, it's done every day. And what we really are seeking is some accommodation. We're not saying that everyone has just the right to go willy-nilly throw up a station, but it's kind of a forced situation because FCC does not have any procedure in place that allows for broadcast stations with 100 watts or less of power. You have to do a minimum 100 watts.
It's a very interesting question because today it's partly a technological question. On the one hand, micro radio is technically possible because people, very largely Steve Dunifer, have developed inexpensive ways of keeping the wavelength properly attuned, in short, doing with very inexpensive equipment what it used to take a large amount of money for. So you can set up a micro station with a half watt, enough, let us say, to serve a housing project for something like $300, in short, for the cost of an ordinary television set. You can set up a station that'll serve the city of Berkeley for a couple of $1,000.
The entry of cost for setting up a station, I mean, using, you know, behind over here equipment we've designed, a station covering up to 12 miles in radius, perhaps more depending on where the antenna is situated, can be put on the air for $1,500 or so dollars. I mean, that is in the range of any community, quite frankly. And we're looking at ways of reducing the cost, particularly at the low end, in the 6 to 15 watt range transmitters. We're redesigning to produce some what we call Model T units that could be easily mass produced at a very low cost.
We broadcasted nearly continuously from February 95 to June of 98. At that time, the FCC approached someone in the Federal Aviation Administration and got someone at the FAA to complain about Free Radio Berkeley, saying that they are broadcasting on aircraft communication channels and could possibly lead to some, you know, plane falling out of the sky or some other aviation disaster. Now, whether this is true or not, we never saw any proof. But we did see copies of correspondence that went back and forth between the FCC and the FAA, where they sort of coached them what they wanted them to say.
How realistic is the worry of interference with airplane traffic, for instance?
Well, it's very realistic. I mean, we've had numerous complaints. When we acted against pirate stations that were interfering, it was because we heard from the FAA.
David Fisk, Federal Communications Commission.
They're very concerned that if a pilot is having his communication is being disrupted, you know, in an emergency, that could be a real problem. Or you could have a music or news or whatever it is, and a small airplane that's far out may not be able to get its signal to the tower to even know that they're out there. So there is no question, either they're off frequency or it's a spurious emission. I'm not an engineer and tell you about, you know, how the signals bounce, but engineers will say that. And talk to the FAA. To them, it is a very real problem. And when we hear about those cases, we move very, very quickly on those kind of cases. It does happen. It did happen.
It's silly. I mean, they'll come out. I mean, for example, we had one microstation in San Francisco that's still on the air, San Francisco Collaboration Radio. Well, the FCC had to drive drive right on top of the station to get some little tiny spur signal that was supposedly in the FM, you know, in the aircraft band. I mean. And they claim this is some grave threat to, you know, air traffic. Well, the point is that when you analyzed their data and looked at the strength of the signal that they claim they found, well, the strength of the signal wasn't sufficient enough to go more than a couple of blocks. So the FCC basically has yet to really prove any solid case of any significant interference issues.
When the Lawyers Guild received their facts of the injunction, they notified Stephen. We had an emergency meeting about it, and then the group at large, FRB, had an emergency meeting. It went on for hours and hours, and we decided it would be in our interest to comply with the injunction and go off the air. So that's what we did in June of 1998.
Kind of like, this is my life, Free Radio Berkeley, these are my friends, you know, when they shut us down the last time, that broke my heart.
Will Henning, Berkeley Liberation Radio.
But, you know, I restrained myself, you know, and waited for the rest of the community to kind of wake up. And when they finally started waking up when they went after Pacifica Radio, and then they finally woke up, which was probably pretty good.
KPFA-FM in Berkeley, founded in 1949, was the nation's first community radio station and had long been known as the voice of the voiceless. But new management at KPFA's owner, the Pacifica Foundation, had been pursuing policies designed to make the station more lucrative and more like NPR, and had been gradually replacing community producers with slicker fare over a 5-year period. Many of those expelled from KPFA joined Free Radio Berkeley. The conflict within Pacifica came to a head in July of 1999 when programmers began to speak out against management policies and broke a piece of shocking news. Secret discussions had taken place about selling KPFA, now worth as much as $100 million as the result of the buyout craze spawned by the 1996 Telecom Act. the Pacifica management shut the doors of KPFA for 3 weeks after protests erupted. Micro Radio stepped into the breach to give a voice to the stunned and dispossessed Bay Area community. Mass demonstrations were held in support of KPFA.
We have a big struggle in front of us. We have to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.